Maboff!
My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. This is Scammapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, please head to iTunes and leave a review. If you really enjoy the show, you might enjoy Scammapalooza Live. Hell no, you will enjoy Scammapalooza Live because it is the upcoming live podcast. We may not actually record it. So when I say live, I mean live. You have to be there in the room this Thursday night, the 19th of January at the Bella Union in Carlton, Melbourne, Australia. It's going to be a huge night. Lawrence Leung from the very first episode of Scammapalooza is going to be there, as well as Dom Chambers, an amazing magician who was there for the Dom and Dumber episode, as well as comedians Bree Williams and Ben McKenzie, and a special guest, Dr. Vyom Sharma, an extraordinary doctor and an incredible performer in his own right. It's going to be a lot of fun, and I'd love to see you there. But enough begging. Just head to the website, conman.com.au, book your tickets, and I'll see you this Thursday, the 19th of January. If you've already missed it, I'm sorry. Sucks to be you. My name's Nicholas J. Johnson. This is Scammapalooza.
Hello, is the lady of the house in?
Oh, no, Homer. Remember, Monty got called up to heaven.
Oh, of course, of course. It's just that...
What?
Well, before she died, she ordered this Bible, especially for you.
Why, there's my name in gold.
Now, you weren't home, so we had to pay the delivery man.
Well, I'll just reimburse you right... Wait a minute. This seems an awful lot like that movie, Paper Moon.
Run, Dad!
Okay. We'll be safe in here.
That's right, I first discovered the film Paper Moon from The Simpsons, along with Ravi Shankar and Iron Butterfly. Because unlike its flashier cousin, The Sting, Paper Moon has faded a little in public memory. This tale of a Dust Bowl-era pseudo-father and daughter swindling their way across the American South has more heart and spark than a dozen Robert Redford vehicles. But even so, it tends to be overshadowed by the huge success of its fancier cousin. On this week's episode of the show, pop culture monocrat Sarah Baggs examines the classic film, the book it was based on, the TV show it inspired, and the massively multiplayer online role-playing game that only exists in my imagination. Oh well, like they say, it's only a paper moon. I'm only Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. It's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. They are the lyrics to the song, It's Only a Paper Moon, which my guest Sarah Baggs did not know existed until tonight. And yet you're here to talk about Paper Moon.
I am.
Straight out of the gate, explain yourself.
Well, wasn't listening to the music, first off, mm-hmm. in the movie, but also I looked up the trivia on the IMDb page for the thing. And it said that, like, the producers were against the title for the movie because it didn't mean anything, mm-hmm. but they kept it because Orson Welles liked it, and he's a friend of Peter Bogdanovich, so...
All right. We are talking, of course, about the classic 1973 Peter
Bogdanovich.
Thank you. Film Paper Moon, mm-hmm. and also the book on which it is based, which is now called Paper Moon and has been called Paper Moon for the last 40 years.
Since 1973, yeah.
Yeah, when the movie came out. But before that was called Addie Prey, mm-hmm. which is the name of the main character.
Yes.
And I guess we're also going to talk about the short-lived TV show. So really we're talking about the whole Paper Moon franchise.
Yes, the whole family of media.
Yes, we're going to talk about the Paper Moon role-playing game.
I'm a level 9 Addie. Roll natural 20 to con that man out
that
of
elderly man.
Yeah, yes. That, you got. We got. We got that one joke.
That one joke. Yes. So this is the classic Dust Bowl Depression era father and daughter. Well, father figure and daughter figure
mm-hmm.
Team up con artist movie that people may not have seen but have certainly heard references to it.
Mm-hmm.
Have. Seen it played out in The Simpsons and other places that have made references to the movie. And I think for me, the most important thing about Paper Moon, it is the last of the pre-Sting con artist films.
Yeah.
So I have this theory that I
every time we talk about con artist films, I talk about is that you can put con artist movies into two categories. Those made before The Sting and those made after The Sting.
Mm-hmm.
And The Sting set up that idea of, you know, con artists at increasingly large scams. And then at the end, when everything falls apart, it turns out that that everything was actually a part of an even larger con, and we, the audience, have been suckered in.
Mm.
And there's that final twist. And this movie does not have that final twist.
It is
very much focused on the characters.
Yeah, yeah. I actually, on a side note, have the same sort of scale, like the pre and after, with Police music. Before Sting, terrible. Mm-hmm. After Sting, excellent. Well, because you said The Sting.
No, I get that. Yeah. No.
It's a joke.
It was a joke.
It's excellent. Fine.
It was good.
Excellent. Thank you.
That's why pencils have erasers. That's why.
We'll get it in editing.
We won't.
Anyway, so yeah, it's I like both genres of con artist movies. I like mm-hmm. the ones that I like the ones where you get the big reveal at the end, but the problem with those movies is you only get that surprise once, whereas movies like this, it's really more of a character study and you can keep enjoying that.
I think, though, post-Sting movies tend to be predictable in their unpredictability, in that you're expecting a twist.
A twist, yeah.
And if you don't get a twist, then you're disappointed. You're not surprised. You're just, you know, disappointed. And it's very, very difficult to fool people anymore.
Even I found that watching this movie, because I watched it years ago and I watched it again last night, and I was waiting for the big twist at the end, and then I remembered how it ended and I was like, all right.
Yeah, I guess that's okay. Yeah. But if you can set that aside, it is a fantastic film.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. It's really, really great. I felt that they took a lot of liberties with the relationship between Addie and Moses, I feel like. In the book, it's a lot more of a paternal relationship, and they love each other, obviously. But in this, the relationship is a lot more strained, and there are a lot more bickery from the start and even towards the end. So I didn't like that change so much. But I think if you look at the movie as a separate piece, then it works.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that, I think, though, that idea of having two characters bickering was, you know, a popular fixture of the 70s and the 60s and 70s throughout adventure films, spy films, crime films, was that you would have people charismatically bickering their way through their adventures. Mm-hmm. So Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, all the kind of Philip Marlowe stuff with the, the dame, the fast talking dame and the private eye. It's kind of what you expect people who love each other to do.
Yeah. That's how you know that they love each other.
Yeah.
Because they fight constantly.
Yeah.
So I really like that. And obviously, she won an Oscar for it, but, the fact that Tatum O'Neill, matches Ryan O'Neill and is, like a worthy adversary in this movie, and they're bickering, but as equals, she's not overshadowed by him. Yeah,
that's right. She is. It is not a film in which the younger character is kind of plays second fiddle to the older character.
He's
or
not.
One in which the younger character outshines the older character by the kind of the stunt,
yeah, not stunt the casting, spectacle but the child, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. In the same way as which if you have a bunch of jugglers and then one of them turns out to be 7 years old, somehow that's more impressive.
Yeah,
seven.
It's a very fine line between like entertainingly precocious and just annoyingly precocious when it comes to kids in movies. And thankfully, Tatum O'Neill didn't turn out to be completely unbearable in this movie.
No, and in later films as well. I mean, The Bad News Bears, International Velvet, even
International Velvet.
Yeah, it was like a remake of the a sequel to National Velvet.
Okay, I just thought you'd got National Velvet completely wrong, and I was like, really? International Velvet?
International Velvet is the sequel, and there's a third one called Intergalactic Velvet.
Velvet. It's just a horse with a space helmet on, just flying through space.
Do you remember when Friday the 13th went into space in the 10th one? It was the same thing. It was like a horse in space. It was pretty good.
In space. That's exactly like that scene in Notting Hill when Hugh Grant is pretending to be the interviewer and he asks if there are any horses in the movie. She's like, no, it's in space. She obviously hadn't heard of Intergalactic Velvet.
Yeah. Well, this is based, that Intergalactic Velvet is based partly on that conversation.
There is why egg aren't there all over her face.
Yeah. There was someone watched Notting Hill and that scene and said, why aren't there more films with horses in space? So we should set up the premise of the film. I think the story of both the film and the book is essentially charting their relationship as they perform a series of scams and cons.
Yep.
And it's where these two very different people, and also very similar people, are going to end up. And that's really all we care about. We don't care about whether they get away with their scams. We don't care.
I care.
Well, I mean, a little, but it's more about, are they going to end up together in the end? So in that way, it felt a little bit like a romantic comedy.
Yeah.
But rather than being a romantic relationship between a man and woman, it was a paternal one.
Absolutely. I completely agree. I was just thinking, I don't like the change that they made with Moses' name. In the book, his name is Moses, but his nickname is Long Boy, and that's what everyone calls him.
Yeah.
And they got rid of that entirely, and I don't know, it bugged me.
Yeah, it me too, because they're both going by pseudonyms for the movie. So yeah. Addie is Addie Prey, which is not her real name.
Mm.
Her real name is Abby Logan.
Addie Loggins.
Loggins, sorry. And his real name is Moses Prey, we assume, and he's going by Long Boy. And so it's this nice thing of they're not playing themselves.
Yeah.
They're playing characters. And so, yeah, I think it would be nice if they'd left it there.
Yeah.
I just realized that father-daughter relationship thing was, has happened. We see that a lot. There is the Australian film and book, The Shira Lee. Do you remember that? With Rebecca Smart and Brian Brown.
Vaguely.
Yeah. Which is the same basic premise, except he is a swagman rather than a
conman.
Rather than a conman for our international listeners, a swagman. Should I need to explain, don't I?
Yeah, I guess
a swagman is basically an Australian hobo.
Yeah, Australian hobo.
Yeah, of which we had quite a few in the 19th century. Mm. And then we also have the movie Curly Sue, 1991.
I loved that movie when we grew up. Next episode that I'm on, we'll talk about Curly Sue.
Is that a con artist film?
I think so, because she has to keep hitting him in the face with the 2x4.
Baseball, but yeah, same thing. He's a homeless man, so again, same sort of thing. She's his companion / daughter, you're not sure relationship is. And Jim Belushi she hits him in the face with a baseball bat or a plank, and he falls in front of cars, and then they hustle the...
the woman,
the woman for money.
I think people, moviegoers, like the idea of a redemptive story of a man caring for a child without the fatherhood obligation.
Yes. Annie.
Yeah, like Annie. Like, so it's like showing the humanity of man. Like, if a man cares for his family, that's a requirement. But if a man cares for someone who may not be related to him, he's doing that out of the goodness of his heart. And I think that, I don't know, I think that might be a formula that movie makers hit on and be like, this is gold.
Les Miserables.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing. Takes exactly on the little girl. Yes.
We've cracked this case wide open.
We
solved the
open.
Da Vinci Code.
Yes, we have. Yeah. That is the thing, the dad and it's the taking on the daughter that you don't have to take on, and that makes them somehow appealing. In that Man on Fire, Denzel Washington film, has the little girl, not his daughter, but same thing. He's like, look, we'll do anything for this little girl.
Yeah, exactly right. I'm sometimes surprised myself with how insightful I can be.
Million Dollar Baby. Clint Eastwood baby. And
that baby.
And the baby.
Yeah.
Anyway.
He paid $1 million for that baby and he didn't have to.
You haven't seen that movie.
I don't know.
So the big thing that the film does is that it tries to make the make it feel as if not only the movie is set in the 1930s, which mm-hmm. is when it's set, it's the Dust Bowl, but that it was made in the 1930s. So it's not just a black and white film, it's monochrome. It's the whites are white and the blacks are black.
It's a black and white shot through a red filter.
Is it really?
Yeah.
And that's how they get that that feeling.
That stark black and white. It was to heighten the contrast. That was Orson Welles' idea. Thank you, IMDb trivia page.
Orson Welles, he's all over this film.
Yeah, yep.
And the shots, they're mostly still, you know, like steady. The camera, when the camera moves, it moves slowly and deliberately.
They're not taking advantage of all the camera techniques that they had in the 70s. It looks like it's from the 30s.
Yeah.
And in the 70s, there was a lot of nostalgia for... Not nostalgia, but there was a lot of that Depression era film. Like, remember the Depression? I think, yeah. So we saw that quite a bit in the time.
Yeah.
But not so much in black and white.
Yeah. Well, there was a fascination with that era, though, around that time. There's Westerns. The last of the Westerns are set in the 1920s and 30s of Mice and Men. I think there was an adaptation of that. So the story begins... in the film and also in the book very quickly. They get straight into it. There is no mucking around. There is no time to set up the characters. Mm-mm. It's straight into the adventure.
You learn as you go.
In the film, it begins with at the graveside of Addie's mother, who has just passed away. Moses has shown up to pay his last respects, where the neighbors kind of point out, oh, you kind of look like her. Maybe you're the dad.
Are you family?
And they basically harass him into delivering Addie to an aunt who lives in Missouri.
St. Joseph.
St. Joseph's in Missouri. And he says, fine, I'll do it. And then heads straight to the local grain mill and convinces I think it's actually the brother of the man
that hit and killed his mum with her mum with a car.
Yeah, and said, you need to give me $200 for the orphan. Otherwise, I'm going to take you and your family to court.
Mm-hmm.
Addie finds out about this and says, that's my $200 and offices suggests that she's going to turn him into the police if she doesn't get her $200. But he's already spent the $200 on a car.
Yeah. So she was so good in that scene.
Yeah, extraordinary.
I was eating it up. Just her face when she's like unwavering, like, I want my $200. And he's trying to reason with her. It's like, you know, I don't have the money. And she's just like, I want my $200.
Yeah.
So good. Like, just, yeah, I completely forgot this movie. That bit's not in the book, though, again.
No. They take a little bit more time to get to that moment.
One of the differences between the book and the movie is with the movie, you have to have the reason for them to stay together and they make it about the money. But in the book, it's just they're kind of fond of each other. So, yeah, I guess they didn't think that theatre goers would understand why these two were together if there wasn't some sort of...
Yeah, is it like there wasn't a plot reason to throw them together? I think, though, with film, you need to show things. And with the book, they can show the inner thoughts and the inner feelings of the characters clearly and succinctly, and you don't have to show that externally. So you need to show some sort of, if you can't show the internal reasons why they're staying together, then you have to show the external reasons. You need to provide external reasons, which is what they did.
Show them.
Yeah.
Did it really make you want a hot dog, that scene? She's eating a hot dog in that. God, I really want a hot dog.
And then I want a pie because they came over and offered pie.
Oh,
and I
was just like,
yep, bring it up. What's great I like about that scene is that it shows not, I don't want to say the innocence, her innocence, but her incorruptibility.
Yeah.
Because she at this point says, you might be my dad. I don't know, but I, you know, you have my jaw, and you took that $200, which belongs to me.
Yeah.
And she is immune to his charms. She's immune to his kind of silver tongue. She's immune to the kind of gray areas of him trying to explain how the world works, even immune to his threats.
Yeah.
Because she's just, she's got that incorruptibility of a kid of that age of just, I know what's what and I know what's mine. And you are not going to bamboozle me.
Yeah. And I liked, that's a theme that comes up in the book as well. Like other people recognize that quality in her. And it's a theme that comes up through the thing that while she is a con artist, she still has a very definite moral compass and knows what the best way to proceed is in all things.
Mm.
I really liked in that scene as well, how she kind of, calls his bluff sort of thing where she says, if you were my dad, it would be different and we could share that money or you would be entitled to that money in some way. But if you're not, give me my money back.
Yeah.
And it's like either take responsibility for me or give me my money. And yeah, I really liked that. Yeah, I like that aspect of it.
Yeah. And you see her moral compass in almost immediately the next scene when, Moses pulls off the Bible scam. And I think that's probably the most famous scam from the book mm-hmm. and the movie. And it is essentially he knocks on a door, says, I'd like to speak to the man of the house. I have, and the woman at the house says, I'm afraid he just passed away.
Because he checks the papers for, for death notices.
Yeah. And the obituaries. And then, sort of acts apologetic and says, I'm sorry. Well, look, he ordered this Bible. And of course it has her name in it. And he makes a big deal about how he wanted nothing but the best for her and mm-hmm. wanted this, you know, and the fact it's a Bible, of course, makes it, you know, somehow more, both spiritual, but also makes him more trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
And, Addie watches all of this, cottons on that, oh, this is a scam. And because of course the wife then, you know, pays the outstanding amount on the cheap Bible. And then, and they pocket the money and she figures this out. But then every time they go to a house, she then decides both how much the person can afford to pay for the mm-hmm. Bible and interrupts him and says, oh no, it's $24, it's $12, it's $6, or whether they deserve to be scammed. So very poor people, she'll say,
the mother who has like 20 kids hanging off her.
Yeah.
And she's like, no, he already paid for this one in full. Don't you remember?
Yeah.
Which, yeah, so it's nice that she has that moral compass. And in the book that comes through as well, that when they have like surplus money or they like con their way into like food and stuff, they leave it on the doorstep of people who are really suffering through the depression. They just like knock on the door and run off and leave like a lot of food and they all come out on the porch and they see it and... Yeah.
It's a little bit more Robin Hood-y.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. But at the same time, I think it does, it's showing her like her strong moral compass, but I think it also is showing her naivety in that she is putting the how much people deserve to be scammed on a sliding scale
from
$0 to $24.
Yeah.
And she's sizing them up and, you know, deciding whether they're worthy of being scammed or not being worthy of scammed. And as the film goes on and she, you know, grows up a little bit and has more experiences, she sees that it's more complicated than it actually appears on the surface and that you can't necessarily do that. So, but this is literally all within the first 20 minutes, 15, 20 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
All of that has already been laid out.
It's very fast paced. I was surprised by how quickly the movie went.
And yet at the same time is not a flashy movie. Mm-mm. Like we said, there's not a lot of cuts. There's a lot of long lingering shots on characters. They'll often focus on the, you know, you will have a conversation going on in which you can't see the people who are talking. You can just see Addie's face. I mean, mm-hmm. the movie opens with
the shot of
her face while, you know, you can hear the funeral going on in the background.
Mm-hmm.
And yet still feels really fast-paced.
Yeah, it's very tight. There's no fat on it whatsoever.
Yeah, which I think was clearly a decision that was made when adapting the book, because the book is, I don't know, it's like 400 pages and mm-hmm. it rambles a lot and goes down little alleyways and comes back and, you know, heads off on scams that are not necessarily they don't further the story or the character development, but they're interesting adventures.
Yeah,
it almost feels. Did it feel serialized to you? Like a
it
bit
did.
Like
there was
chapter
very
by chapter?
Distinct, yeah, movements in the book, and you're like, okay, now we're talking about this scam, and now we're talking about this scam, and while there's always, you know, when there's a possibility of there being. They're going to fall on hard times. She's like, oh, we could go back to selling the Bibles, but they kind of never go back to the same con twice in the story. Mm. It's just very like, this is what we're doing now. This is what we're doing next. But I did miss some of the scams that were in the book though, I got to say. The one with the cotton in the book I really liked, which is where there's warehouses where you can sell your cotton and you take it into a room where they assess the quality and then they put a little sample of the cotton on a little ticket and then you go and find a buyer and just based off the sample they'll give you a price and they can collect it from the warehouse whenever. So Longboy gets his hand on some of these tickets and he just rounds up some scrap cotton and he starts going around selling this cotton that isn't really there. I loved that con. I really liked it. As I was reading it, I was like, oh my God, this man's a genius.
Yeah, I would totally do that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think part of the reason why that is not in the film is that Addie doesn't play a massive role in
That's
it.
That's true.
She's just an observer and it's interesting as a scam, but it's not, it doesn't do anything for the characters. And also in the movie, for the most part, it's something you see a lot in these kind of Dust Bowl epics is that you just have long stretches of empty countryside and farmland mm-hmm. and then a little town, a little shop, two characters standing on the side of the road, a deserted farmhouse. You might see a police officer, but mm-hmm. you don't necessarily see the large institutions playing mm-hmm. out in these kind of stories. You don't see politics, you don't necessarily see larger, you know, corporations. And I think with the cotton, it always felt like this is a big deal because it wasn't just like, let's go to this cotton guy. And it was like they were a part of this whole big system. And I think that for the purposes of the film, in keeping it small and keeping it intimate and keeping it personal, I think it was better to stick with the short cons that they did.
That's true. The only thing that just occurred to me just now is that a big part of that whole cotton scam is that they have to forge the handwriting of the office worker who writes out the little tickets.
Yeah.
And so one of the things in the book is that Addie gets really adept at forging handwriting. And later when we see the part of the movie and the book with Trixie Delight, and part of that is that she forges someone's handwriting. She does it in the movie, but it's not really explained why she's able to do that.
Yeah.
And in the book, she can forge handwriting really well. She's good at it. So that's, I mean, something you would absolutely not notice if you hadn't read the book. But
yeah. So Trixie is a great character who comes in as a love interest of sorts for Longboy / for Moses, and in the film is played by Madeline Kahn.
So well.
Oh my God. Just so good. So amazing because she presents herself like she's a star of the screen and stage mm-hmm. and she's a big celebrity when in fact she is a,
just white trash.
White trash. She's like a sideshow dancer. Sideshow dancer / prostitute.
Yeah, like / prostitute if there's a good enough price.
If there's enough money. Yeah. But she has a servant girl who follows
Imogene.
Her around.
The actress who played Imogene in the movie, I thought she stole the show for the bit that she was in it. She was so good.
Yeah, yeah. It's this young black woman and she's got these big Coke bottle glasses mm-hmm. and her hair, I don't know what that hairstyle is called.
Yeah, I don't know what that's called. But like the little braids, but like all over her head.
Yeah. And she was just a brilliant character, just stole every scene she was in. Both of them were just brilliant. And I kind of wish they were in the movie for longer.
Yeah, I wish there was more scenes with Imogene and Addie together.
Yeah.
Because the scene with the two of them talking in the back of the car, I thought it was one of the best of the whole movie. It was so interesting that you've got this girl, Imogene, who's like, she's in her teens, But there's also Addie, who's supposed to be, you know, like 7 years younger than her, but they're equals because Addie's got her street smarts and she sort of makes up in life experience what she lacks in age. And these two people who would never have anything in common otherwise, they're able to relate on the same level because they've had similar, like, equitable amounts of life experience already.
Yeah, it's the closest Addie gets to sort of a friend.
Yeah, exactly in the right.
Film. And you have the brilliant scene where Addie is jealous of Trixie and doesn't want her in the car, and it's you're not sure whether she just doesn't like her or whether it's she doesn't want to share Moses. Mm-hmm. She's like, this is my father figure and you're coming in.
Yeah.
And it's this weird sort of like, oh, you're the stepmother.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a brilliant scene on a hillside. The car stopped by the side of the road. Addie's kind of refusing to get back in the car.
Mm-hmm.
And Trixie comes up and basically tries to charm Addie by saying, "I'll do your hair. I'll
teach you how to use makeup.
When your boobs get in, then the boys are really interested, and you might be more beautiful than I am." And and just has no effect. And then she turns her back, and then turns back and says, "You know,
let's talk honestly now.
Let's talk honestly now." And rather than saying, you know, "I'll give you $50, or rather than being cynical, she's brutally honest and says, "Look, guys don't keep me around very long. And that's just the way it is. And I don't know why it is, but it's just who I am. And can you just please give me a break. And then she just looks at Addie with this really sad, embarrassed look. Addie smiles and gets back in the car, and she's this really nice moment. What is brilliant about it is Madeline Kahn's performance in that is so uncomfortable and so awkward.
It's real.
It's real because she was uncomfortable and awkward about delivering the line.
Yeah, the line she says, she's like, because the argument is Addie wants to sit in the front seat.
Yeah.
And Trixie says, "Let Trixie sit up the front with her big tits." And Madeline Kahn did not want to say that line. So her awkwardness is genuine awkwardness.
Mm.
Which is funny to me. I would never have picked Madeline Kahn as someone who would be squeamish about saying something like that.
I don't know.
Because I think of her as such an irreverent person. I guess maybe she wasn't. Maybe she was a bit more proper than I give her credit for.
Yeah, perhaps. All I think of is Mrs. White in the movie.
Yeah, that's
Clue.
What I was thinking of. Or also, I loved her in What's Up, Doc?
Yeah.
Playing Eunice. Oh, so good.
Yeah. And there's a brilliant film where it's a really slow moving, I've forgotten the name of it, film from the 70s about a, might even be made for TV. And it's about a little girl and boy who run away from home and decide to live in the museum, New York's, I forgot the big museum in New York. And they just stay there for a few days and sleep there at night. And she's there as a tour guide in one scene. And it just completely steals the entire movie and then just disappears from the rest of the film.
I have to look it up. I love her. She's great.
So fantastic. Yeah. So, and in this, she's brilliant as well.
Do you think that in that scene, Addie is going along with it because she respects Trixie's candor, or do you think it's because Addie realizes that there's a way she can speed up the natural process of getting rid of her, because that's ultimately what she does? Like, do you think that the her planting the seed in her mind that, you know, I will eventually be gone, I can be gotten rid of faster?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely not a, oh, you're just a regular person and you know, you're a real, the candor does not make her more human. It just makes her more vulnerable.
Yeah.
And Addie then sees she can take advantage of it.
Absolutely. Cause
you see the same, she gives the same smile in the end of, there's a scene where she goes into the shop. Moses goes in and pays for some chewing gum with a $20 note, which has on it, "Happy birthday, Addie."
Mm-hmm.
And, given face down, and then she goes up and tries to pay for something with a $5 note and doesn't get enough change and bursts into tears and says, "I gave you $20 and the shop girl says, "No, it was $5 big argument. She goes, "It had happy birthday, Addie. It was from my aunt, and you look, and I'm not lying." And of course they find it, and Addie smiles, and it's a really this sweet smile of little girl who realizes everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
That just changes into something else.
Yeah,
and she gives that same something else smile at the end of the scene with Madeline Kahn, where she's like just clicking along. Oh, I can control this, which she then does with by when basically that, and this is when Imogen basically they convince the clerk at the hotel to go and visit Trixie.
Yeah, so they tell Trixie that the clerk at the desk wants to have sex with her for a price.
Mm-hmm.
And they tell the clerk at the desk that she wants to have sex with him because he's hot.
Yeah.
And then they craft a way to get them together and for Longboy for Moses to catch them.
Yeah.
And she promises Imogene that if she helps her with this, then she'll give her enough money to get home to her mum, because working for Trixie is not everything that Trixie promised Imogene it would be.
And this, and it all works perfectly.
Yeah.
And which is, I guess, the first sign from Addie that she is, you know, that she's using her powers for evil.
Yeah.
She is using it to...
And she's a conning genius. Like, yeah. I would never in my wildest dreams be able to think of something that clever.
Or pull it off.
Yeah. No, yeah. Never.
Yeah.
I found the moment the after they pull off this scam, you sort of expect there to be like a, well, let's drop Imogene off at the train station or something, because that's what they've promised. But it's literally... Moses is like, we're leaving now, and Addie runs after him, and there's just this image of a hallway and Imogene standing in it and sort of just like weakly waving to her, and you kind of like it's just left up to your imagination whether she got home or whether she felt bad for Trixie and stuck around. Or
yeah, she gives her the money though. She gives
Do you see her give her the money? I thought that you didn't. Like, I assumed that she did give her the money, because why would she not? But
yeah,
just that it's a beautiful shot of Imogene just standing in the hallway waving goodbye forlornly.
Yeah.
Like sort of left to pick up the pieces.
But it's a nice, rather than, because those people are now out of their lives, and you want it to be like a cruel cut.
Yeah.
You don't want it to be like a, you know, like the end of an episode of Lassie, where Lassie says, you know, goodbye and trots out of town, and the, you know those people are going to be okay. It's that.
Yeah, yeah.
You see a similar thing in Boyhood, where they leave the abusive leave the abusive stepfather,
and it's so abrupt.
It's so abrupt, and you never see those characters
again.
And you're
like,
what happened to those kids?
Okay?
You don't know. You don't find out, and it's just they're dead. And that's
That was one of the bits I liked about that movie.
One of the few bits. Oh, so me too.
Oh, thank God.
Great. Can we do a whole episode about why Boyhood?
What a load of shit. Just a mantelpiece covered in guns that never get fired.
Yes.
Most boring movie I've ever seen.
Damn you, Chekhov. Anyway, so the book then from this point goes off on a variety of different, you know, variety of different directions. They go to New Orleans for the whole second half of the book.
Yeah.
And there's a whole variety of scams there, which I guess we'll talk about in a second. But in the film, they go to Kansas next, and this is the bootleggers.
Mm-hmm.
This is when they basically just decide to steal whiskey and sell it back to the bootlegger.
Yeah, they make this like the climax of the film, where in the book it's a much more minor thing. So they sell the whiskey back to the bootlegger, and Longboy kind of realizes too late that he's made a mistake, interfering with a bootlegger who wouldn't want competition in the area.
Yeah, and whose brother is a sheriff.
I really liked in the movie that they had the bootlegger and the brother played by the same actor. I thought that was really good.
Yeah. And not immediately noticeable.
Well, because what they did was to play the bootlegger, they had him put on some weight and then shot the brother scenes later after he'd lost the weight. So the bootlegger's like a little bit fatter than the deputy, the sheriff.
Wow. And then they just shot around it.
Yeah.
Which shows how carefully crafted the film is.
Yeah.
How every shot, I mean, it's that, you know, like Is it every frame of painting? Is that the...
Yeah.
That this is a film where you can see that on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
You could take any frame of the movie and just stop and you would have a beautiful frame shot. And you couldn't do what you're talking about in 1973 without taking, you know...
Yeah, and being thoughtful about what you were doing.
Who plays the the bootlegger?
I forget what his name was.
Randy Quaid played Leroy.
Randy Quaid was in it. I saw him last night. I was like, holy shit, that's Randy Quaid. He's 23 in this movie.
Yeah,
I didn't even realize that Randy Quaid had ever been 23 at any point in his life.
I thought he'd always been vaguely 50 and insane.
I thought he came out like 35 years old and just went on from there.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, he looks exactly the same. It's like he stepped off the set of that movie and immediately became the brother from Christmas Vacation.
Yes.
Because he's exactly the same sort of white trash.
John Hillerman played both Deputy Harden and Jesse Harden.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
So once Longboy realizes he's made a mistake, they leave town immediately, but not soon enough, and they're caught by the police.
Basically then just escape. Like they get arrested, but then they escape.
Yes, with some fancy driving, and they
sped up fancy driving too.
Oh, in the movie, it's a much more tense scene.
Yeah.
So yeah, I couldn't believe the things I was seeing this car doing. You can tell that they've sped the footage up a little bit.
That makes it feel like it's a because that's what you did in the 1930s. You sped up the film to make it look like the cars were going faster.
I just expected like Benny Hill to pop out somewhere and chase a little ball guy.
Yeah, like, it did feel very fast. Yeah, I guess so.
But it was very thrilling, and I liked the skidding all over the road that they were doing. There's one part where they're running from the cops and they have to go over the river into, what is it, Missouri?
Yep.
They have to get over the river, and he's like, oh, the bridge is back the other way. We're going the wrong way. So they just have to chuck a Yui and like drive past the cops who are coming the other way towards them. And it was very tense.
Yeah.
I kind of was a little sad, and this is probably one of the bits that I missed the most that was from the book. In the book, they drive into some like back roads and they find this old guy who lives in a little hut in the woods, and he hides the car for them and they stay there for a few days, and he's a really nice guy and he helps them for no real reason while they try to get another car to replace the car that they've got, because in the book Trixie has made Longboy buy this very flashy car that's very obvious, so they've got to get something more inconspicuous. And I missed that bit because it's a really nice moment. Like they just, for a few days, they have a place that's like homey. They're having home cooked meals. They're with this old guy. And in this, they're at this, they're at this old guy's place for all of like 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Not just in movie time, but like literally they're there. They arrange a swap of the car and then they're off again.
Yeah, then there's a fight scene, isn't there? They kind of beat up the hobo and the hobo beat up the hillbilly and they escape.
Yeah, the Randy Quaid, he's like the ringleader of these guys, and he doesn't want to swap their pickup truck for this fancy car because they can't haul anything with it, like it's not a farming car. And then Longboy Moses says he'll wrestle him for it.
Yeah.
Which is so good.
Yeah.
It's really good. And you get this moment of Addie seeing Moses in this new light because she didn't think that he was capable of anything where he'd have to get his hands dirty. And she gets that extra bit of respect for him. And it is, like, pretty impressive. He, like, kicks the guy right in the face.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's pretty much the end of the film. I mean, like, that's the end of the con artist action. There's nothing. So really, the last big scam is they steal from a bootlegger and then sell it back and get in trouble and lose the money and escape. Oh, no, they've hidden the money.
Yet.
That's right. They've hidden the money and they escape. And then they... But of course, that's not what the film is about. The film is about, do they stay together or do they go their separate ways?
Yeah.
And that's all we want to find out. And so that... Yeah, that's something that in the book is not, you know, is still there. But after that, they go off and have several more adventures before they even start to kind of bring that into, sort of bring that issue up. So should we have a look at the other, I think it's there's three other adventures that they have in the book that they've been left out of the movie.
Do you want to talk about how the movie ends before? Because the movie ends in such a dramatically different way to the book.
Like, yeah, okay. So at this point, Addie and Moses drops Addie off at the aunt's
house. No, you've missed the. They're going to stay together at this point. Like they've got a truck, and they're happy that they've got away with it. And they start to formulate their next scheme, but in like another state. As they're heading off to do their last big scam, what you assume will be the last scam of the movie, the sheriff from before has caught up with them again. He's tracked them down. And even though he has no jurisdiction in this town, they chase him down and they just beat the crap out of him and they take all his money. And that's the point where he says, you have to go back to your aunt's because this is dangerous. This is terrible. Like, we're back to having no money.
Yeah.
You got to go.
But it was more, I got the impression it was more like he was embarrassed and he was humiliated and he felt like,
yeah,
I mean, it was like, yeah, it's dangerous, but it's also like, this is, I'm meant to be this big father figure to you and this is what it's been up and down. Yeah. And now you're watching me getting the shit kicked out of me.
What I kind of, I don't know if this is just me not focusing on the right things, but what happens is Addie, you don't really find out what the con is supposed to be, but Addie's supposed to be on a certain corner and they're meeting this other guy at a certain time and he's not there. And the guy that their mark like wanders off. And then you just hear him, you hear Mo's like pitifully being like, Addie. And she finds him and he's like in this, like in a doorway that's like down a set of stairs, that's right there. And I just thought it was really considerate of them to drop him off where he needed to be. Like, because when they catch up with him and they beat him up, he is nowhere near there. Nowhere near. And they're like, well, okay, we've beaten the crap out of him. Let's put him in the car. Yeah.
Can we drop you somewhere? Yeah, he got an Uber.
Yeah, that's
it. Yeah.
First trip is like 20% off. We can take you.
So this is the point. You're right. This is the point where Addie gets dropped off at the aunt's house. Moses drives away. And you think that they're not going to stay together.
Mm.
And at which point Addie basically chases after him, jumps in the car and says, he says, get out of, you know, no, I don't want to continue. Mm. And she says, you still owe me $200.
Yeah.
And they, yeah. And then there's a little comedy stinger of the truck. Starts
rolling down.
Yeah, yeah. And so they have to sort of, you know,
yeah,
like chase after it and they leave together and mm-hmm. it's this nice upbeat comic moment for the film to end on.
Mm.
So it's everything is small and intimate. The stakes financially are never that big.
No.
There's a sense like they might get caught and go to jail, but it's small town sheriffs and you know, kind of parochial lynch mobs. It's very much about, are these guys going to make it as a
couple? Yeah.
Yeah. As a couple. And that's all you really care about. Not everything you care about, but that seems the thing.
That's the most important thing.
And so the fact that they end up together is like, phew, everything is okay.
Yes.
And they're going to go and live their lives together. So mm-hmm. I think that works. And it is, I guess, you could almost call it a romantic comedy in that you have the two characters that you keep apart until the end of the film, which is something we talked about with Martin Dunlop when we talked about... I Love You, Philip Morris, and Focus, about those films as being like romantic comedies. And this is the same thing. You have these two people, you keep them together. Will they or won't they? And then they do and everything's happy and we move on. But because I think that it could be a really disposable movie, couldn't it? Because there's no big set pieces. You know, there's some car chases, but like you said, they're fairly, you know, like they're not. You know, this sped up footage. There's no huge amounts of money involved. The stakes are never that high, and you've got a very cheery, nice ending at the end. A lot of kind of good natured bickering and bantering, and yet the film elevates above all of that.
Yeah,
and it somehow feels like not just a good fun movie, but a great piece of cinema. And I still don't know why that is, beyond just the craftsmanship of watching.
Yeah. Peter Bunker. I was thinking about this because I've seen this movie twice now. And the first time I watched it, my mum made me watch it when I was still living at home. I was probably maybe 12 or so. And as I was watching this movie, I was enjoying it, but I was like, how did my mum get me to watch this? Like, it's black and white. It's, you know, it's not the sort of movie that I would have thought that I would enjoy as a kid.
But I watched it again this afternoon with Bea, my daughter. She's three. Every time Addie and Moses were talking, she would stop what she was doing and go and sit down in front of the TV and watch it. And I'm going, do you know what this is about, honey? And she's like, no. No, and she's like it, but every time there was action or the scams or the cons, and she'd want to, you know, she'd disappear, or she's like, "Can we watch Peppa Pig or whatever?" But as soon as they were talking, she would go, "Oh, this is a thing. This is important."
Well, see, that's the greatest testament to the enjoyability of the movie. If you can get a 3-year-old to watch it,
yeah,
then it's solid.
That's actually that's what focus groups are now for films. Mm. Like, they're basically just designed. Can you get a 3-year-old to sit through this movie? Mm. And if they do, then it works. If they don't, then it doesn't.
Mm.
Which explains, you know, Ghostbusters. Hey!
Oh, snap. It's a
topical reference. So the book then has these three extra scams that happen. Yeah. First thing they do is they head to New Orleans. They escape after the bootlegger action, and they head to New Orleans.
So Longboy never gets beaten up by the sheriff. They escape from the jail, and that's that.
Like, yeah,
it's done.
Yeah.
I like the bit where they go to see FDR. That's a short bit, but very enjoyable.
Yep.
Sorry. So they Addie is like really enamored with the idea of FDR, and Longboy tells a bunch of people where he's going to appear that she's like the vice president's daughter or something like that, to get her to the front of the throng of people, and like she's right there and she gets to meet him. I really like that. It's just short, but it's nice.
They reference that briefly in the film.
Yeah, they keep talking about FDR
as a but he's mostly a voice on the radio.
And she can't say his name right, and he keeps like throwing it in her face when they're arguing.
They call him Frankie.
Yeah, yep. Frankie Roosevelt.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they meet this guy in a hotel, and they realize that he is also a con artist, and they sort of throw their lot in with him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, he's got one last big scam to get a lot of money, like more money than they've ever had before.
Yeah, which is something that you would normally expect from – you would normally add in a scene like this to a movie to give it a big – third act finish.
Yeah,
and instead
exactly.
He decided, no, we'll get rid of that. We don't need it, because he felt like he could tell the story. You could tell the character story just up to the bootlegger.
Mm.
So you had the wool we mentioned, that's not in the
That's not in there.
There's also a miracle tonic.
The
prune juice, magical prune juice.
With yeast in it. It's like a tonic.
Yeah. Which, if people are interested, we haven't already heard it. We had Tosh Greenslade tell a classic O. Henry short story, which was also about a miracle tonic, set around roughly the same time, a little bit earlier. You know, sort of snake oil salesman thing. And you should have a listen to that, because it's got some great lingo of the snake oil salesman. And it's a really short story with a little twist.
Mm.
So people haven't listened to that. I think it's like episode 28. Tosh Greenslade reads the story and does all the voices. And it's a nice moment. So you can watch Paper Moon and then listen to our little radio play. And you're almost all the way to getting the book. Anything to avoid reading. And then finally, this is the big one: is the widow, the elderly woman that they decide to try and scam.
So there's a very very rich woman, like this old, an old widow, and she has a granddaughter who is lost, possibly dead, and that this grandma is trying to find, because she has no one to leave all her riches to, and she wasn't on good terms with her daughter, and then she died, and she's trying to do this redemptive thing of getting, of finding the granddaughter. And Addie's about the right age. In the book, she's 12. In the movie, she's 9. They changed it a little bit to suit Tatum O'Neill. But yeah, she's about the right age. And yeah, basically the idea is for her to move in with the old woman and just wait out the old woman's life. And when she dies, then they all get the money and they get to split it. And it's supposed to be like millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But then through living there, Addie learns that this illusion of wealth, it's just a complete farce. The grandmother's financial advisor embezzled all her money and she has nothing. So the colonel, the con artist that they're working with, helps them to flip the con and take advantage of the greedy nephew of the grandmother instead, who's the one who's employed them to con her in the first place. It's very complicated.
Yeah.
But I say it all in one long thing.
No, but it's and it's an entirely different type of scam to what we've seen.
It's
the long con. In the movie, at no point is anyone put on the send, I don't think, in the film. So a short con is a scam in which you take people for the money that they have on them.
Mm-hmm.
So you walk into a shop, you take that money,
you
say, I want to sell you this. The person says, okay. And they give you the cash. Maybe the bootlegger possibly was, you know, going to get the money, but even then it's not a complex long con. Whereas this is multiple stages, multiple people involved playing different characters. And so you can see why, they decided to remove it from the film, because it doesn't feel the same as the rest of the film. It doesn't have that starkness and that kind of small scale of everything else that was going on.
Mm.
Yeah. And to be honest, I remember by that point of the book, I was going, this better have a big finish. This better be drawing up to something, because it's not getting, you know.
Really? Did you struggle through the book?
I didn't struggle through the book, but I felt like it was that every time they would end up starting a new scam or a new adventure or a new town, I felt like it wasn't building. It was serialized.
Resetting.
I felt a little bit like I was reading, you know, Encyclopedia Brown mysteries. You know, each chapter is a different adventure.
Would you have been disappointed if the book had ended more like the movie and just sort of petered out with a like, oh, that's nice?
Yeah, maybe I probably would have. Yeah. I'm very easy to disappoint.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Am I disappointing you now?
Well, let's be honest, this is petering out just a little. All right, let's just talk quickly about the film was accepted by, you know, people enjoyed it. It wasn't the instant classic. Although it did win, Tatum O'Neill got the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actress.
Mm.
And
I think that was a slap in the face. I hate it when they do this.
Is that really an appropriate thing to say, considering, were you telling me she got a slap in the face?
Oh, no, no pun intended. Oh my God, that's horrible.
Tell the story, because I did not know this until you told me.
I was reading the trivia on IMDb, and according to Tatum O'Neill's autobiography, when she won the Oscar, with Ryan O'Neill not having even been nominated for an Oscar, he hit her. Because I literally didn't know this till last night, but he was like an abusive asshole.
Yeah.
I had no idea. And through this whole movie, I've thought for many years that Ryan O'Neill is super hot. And through this whole movie, I was just like, oh, Ryan O'Neill, family man. And then when I read that, it turned me off instantly. I was like, ew, what a dirtbag. Like, he was beating her while they were filming the movie. It just... but what I was saying, the slap in the face thing, I really resent this thing that the Academy does where they take young actresses who are in lead roles and they nominate them for Best Supporting under the pretense of like, oh, they have more of a chance of winning for Best Supporting. They did it to the girl in True Grit. They're like, Best Supporting. She was the main character. She's the narrator. She's on the screen the longest. Like, they nominated her for Best Supporting?
Yeah.
That, like, she didn't win Best Supporting either. I feel like it would have been better for her to be nominated for Best Actress and not get it than to be nominated for Best Supporting, which she wasn't, and not get that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's that idea of like, well, if you're a child, you can only really be supporting.
Yeah.
Then again, The Martian, didn't that win Best Comedy? You know, so it's clear that when people get nominated for the awards, it's about can we win an award, not can we win the most appropriate award.
Yeah, exactly right.
That's it. So Ryan O'Neill and Tatum O'Neill had an awful relationship. They were estranged for many years. They have reunited about sort of 4 or 5 years ago for some reason. But it was apparently like of his four children, three of them were estranged from him for many years.
He wasn't interested in talking to him.
Not great. There was a lot of talk of drugs and alcohol, in her upbringing.
Yeah.
And she obviously had a lot of problems. So
they did that to kids all the time. They did that, like, just in the pursuit of getting that good movie, pumping kids full of amphetamines and stuff.
Yeah.
They destroyed Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney.
Yeah. I don't know whether they did that in the making of this film, though.
Oh, no, who knows? But, yeah. You know.
But it's certainly that Tatum O'Neill did not live up to her potential after this. And most of that can be put down to shitty parenting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess, though, like, aside from just being gossip, it adds an extra dimension to the film, because what you have is a bad father-daughter relationship in the real world, and then on screen you have a fake but good father-daughter relationship. So it's and when you see them on the on the screen, and even when they're arguing, you can see the kind of it's like you have a you can see them acting like a like they love each other, and they probably do, but they're just not
they don't know how to show it.
Oh, I don't know if they don't know how to show it, but just, you know, they're incapable of showing it. There is a scene, and I'll see if I can find it, but it's basically there is a some outtakes in which Ryan O'Neill is being they're in a restaurant, I think. It's in the hotel scene, and he's eating food. And
is it the one with the waffles?
I think it's with the waffles.
Yeah.
And she kept mucking up her lines or giggling or something is going wrong, and Ryan O'Neill keeps having to eat
waffles. I got to say, in that scene, I know that everything is about food for me in movies, but it was the worst looking waffle I've ever seen. It was so flat, and like waffles are one of my favorite food. I'm like, that waffle sucks.
Yeah.
If he was upset about having to keep eating those waffles, I completely understand.
What he does is sort of a fake kind of sort of pretending to strangle her. Think, oh, you're pissing me off now.
Yeah,
and it looks like he's kind of on his best behavior because there's people watching.
And
that it just makes me really sad.
When you know what their relationship was like.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yes, yes.
That's so horrible.
Yeah. So anyway, let's leave that, because I don't want to just gossip about people's shitty lives.
No, but it is interesting in the context of the film. And also I noticed that I have one source of information for this movie, which is the trivia page on IMDb.
I love the trivia page of IMDb. It's my crack.
In an interview, he said that like the movie couldn't have worked if it had been him with any other kid. He's like, it had to be Tatum. It had to be my daughter for us to have that relationship. And it's like, how can you say that when you treated her like that? It seems like such a hollow remark to make when you consider that he didn't treat her as well as he definitely should have.
Yeah. And also, like, are you, like, you hate children so much that you can't act like a dad in a film?
Yeah,
and you're not
exactly.
A great. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely both troubled people. Let's just say that. So the legacy of the film is it became a classic, I guess, sort of later on. I mean, it made it made money and it won success, but it was the same year as The Sting, and The Sting really, I mean, that won all the Academy Awards, and it's the one that people remembered the most, and it was it had Robert Redford, and it was clearly the blockbuster. It was very the Paper Moon is very much the deep impact to the Sting's Armageddon.
It's that other movie about Capote to Capote.
Yeah.
You know, that other Capote movie that came out the same year with Toby Jones?
Yeah, that's actually quite good. They made a short-lived pilot, which I said 10 years later, but it was like 2 years later.
Yeah.
They made a pilot and the first season of a series on CBS called Paper Moon that was meant to be the continuing adventures of Addie and Moses, and it was not great. It was a sitcom. It didn't have a laugh.
Sitcom?
Yeah, it was in color.
Multi-camera?
No. It was color, but there was no laugh track.
What's the deal with conning people?
Yeah, it was 26 minute episodes.
That's so strange.
It was played
what
for
a weird
laughs.
Choice.
Yeah, it's played for laughs, but it was meant to be very whimsical and fun. But it didn't last. And in fact, if you listen just to the first 30 seconds of the series, you can tell why. Let me just play a little bit for you now. Hang on.
Mose.
Uh-huh.
We got $306,083.
Uh-huh.
Think we could settle down?
Mm-hmm.
Buy a house?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I love you, Mose.
I love you too, Addie.
So there you go. First scene of the film is them,
like, the least likely thing for those characters to do.
Yeah,
ever.
They're lying on the they're lying down by a riverbank, and she says, "We've got all this money. Can we buy a house and settle down together?" And he says, "Sure, whatever." And then she goes, "I love you. I love you too." Like, no,
what?
That is
they would never say that.
The whole point, the whole end of the film is that she doesn't want to settle down and he doesn't want to settle down, and they're going to go out and have adventures on the road together.
Mm-hmm.
And they would never say, "I love you. I love you."
Yeah. No,
I mean the rest of the episode, it does go off in interesting directions, but it's flat and two-dimensional.
Yeah. It just feels like so tone deaf to the original subject matter. Like someone thought, yes, this captures the essence of the movie. No.
No.
No, no.
No, it doesn't. It just doesn't work. What is great is that about the film is that all the relationship is there, but everything feels very real. It feels like of the time, of the era. It's not only have they tried to make it look like it's set in the 1930s, it's tried to make it feel like it's in the 1930s.
Mm-hmm.
And the way in which the scams all play out are the way in which those scams are supposed to play out, historically speaking.
Mm.
So I have some more audio. It's just the fast change scene. This is when they're buying the ribbons. She's buying the ribbons in the in the shop.
And I don't understand this.
Okay.
Like, I don't have a maths brain. And
no.
I was trying to figure this out, and I was like, I definitely would have fallen for this scam, like right. 1,000,000%.
Okay, let me play it and see if you can figure it out. Hang on.
You look real nice in that ribbon. First off, I didn't know, was she a boy or a girl?
I'm a girl.
Well, it makes all the difference. Ain't she got a sweet little face, somehow?
Well, seeing how I just got paid today, we'll take a ribbon in each color. How much is that going to set me back?
Well, that'll be 15 cents. Bought my grandchildren ribbons just like this last holiday time.
Grandchildren, I don't believe it. You break a five?
So
well, you can
he hands
believe
over
it,
$5.
Right. I'm just as old as I look. Well, now, here you be. That's five.
You know, this old wallet of mine's about to bust its sides. I'll give you five ones back. You give me that $5 bill.
Okay, so
how
you just handed over five ones
well,
in exchange for a $5 bill.
9-year-old, a 10-year-old.
Yep,
two grandsons
fair.
Near 16. And I got a grandson 35 years old.
Oh, come on, you're pulling my leg. Why don't you just give me a $10 bill? Here's the five.
So he just gave back the $5 and said, now give me a 10.
Six children, huh?
In exchange, before she has a chance
51.
To put her money away.
Oh, she's
no, I don't mean to be handing you no line, but that's just pretty hard to believe you got a 51-year-old child.
Yeah. So basically, it's the five.
I'm afraid I have to see it to believe it. Much of life.
No, it's not. But what is clever is the dialogue.
Yeah, it's the chatting. Making her think about something else while he's doing it. Because the second that they walk out the door, she immediately goes, hang on. And she starts counting the money in the till. Like,
yeah, actually, let's listen to that.
just don't seem quite right. Somehow?
Yeah. So, but the basic idea is that she's holding five ones in her hand. He's holding a $5 note in his hand. And they have just swapped those. So it was her $5. They were his five ones. They're swapped. He talks to her for a bit. And then he says, actually, I'll give you this $5 and you give me 10.
Mm.
So she's given him 10 so that everything is fair.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, he has then given her five in mm-hmm. exchange for 10. And that's
so he's making $5.
Yeah.
And then later in the movie, we see Addie do the exact same thing to a guy at the carnival who's selling fairy floss.
Yeah.
Or cotton candy for the internet listeners.
but it was great. It works.
Yeah.
But it is just a little less elaborate and just sort of, you know, elbows her way through it. So it's, you know.
Did you think that it kind of took me out of the movie for a second because I kind of thought, why would a fairy floss vendor have such huge notes? Like,
yeah.
Why?
Yeah. It would all be nickels and dimes.
Yeah,
and,
yeah, exactly. Like, why would he need to have a $10 note? Why?
Yeah.
But anyway, but it's a nice little touch to show that Addie is learning from Mose.
Yeah. So to finish up with, the reason why you're here is because you are a pop culture expert and you are a podcasting king.
I am a king.
What are your podcasts?
Okay, so I've got a few. Sit tight. Okay, so my favorite is It's a Duck Blur, where mm-hmm. my husband and I watch every episode of DuckTales. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, we took a break from DuckTales. We're just watching Christmas episodes of other TV shows. We saw the Christmas He-Man special, which was great. So if you like that, check that out.
Is that just because you're trying to stretch out the how long you can do the podcast for before you run out of duck?
No, Michael and I have always wanted to do a podcast where we just watch Christmas episodes of things. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of indulging that of ours. The Pop Quiz Hot Shot, which is mm-hmm. a movie trivia quiz show, which you've been on.
I've been on a couple of times. Yeah, yeah. I think I won once and lost once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spurging Out, which is with my brother. And it's about how he has Asperger's and we answer advice questions, mm-hmm. which aren't very good advice because you don't want to act like him. And my other one is Wiki How We Do It, which is with my friend Bassem, and we challenge each other to improve ourselves using WikiHow articles.
Bang. Wow, that is a lot of podcasts.
Too many podcasts, I think.
Yeah, I can barely get by with one.
I know. It's too much. I have no social life.
And you are on social media a lot. You have nice Instagram and Twitter businesses.
What sure. I have a Twitter. It's... at why in the heck with underscores between the words.
Mm-hmm.
If they go to your Twitter, they'll probably find me on there.
I'll put it up there. Yep.
Sure.
And on Instagram is no.
Instagram, it's @_nodogsallowed.
Lovely. Excellent. All right. Then to take us out, let's listen to the song that gave the title to the book, to the movie, to the TV series, to the soft drink,
to this episode of
episode of the podcast, Ella Fitzgerald, It's Only a Paper Moon. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. This is Scamapalooza.
Say it's only a paper moon sailing over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Without your love, it's a honky-tonk parade. Without your love, it's a melody played in a penny arcade. It's a Barnum and Bailey world, just as phony as it can be. But it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me.
Say it's only a paper moon,
paper
sailing
moon
over a cardboard sea, but it wouldn't be make-believe if you believed in me. Yes, it's only a canvas sky hanging over a muslin tree, but it wouldn't be make-believe.
Barnum and Bailey were just as phony as it can be. Oh,